and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Now the hard part starts. Russia and the United States agree the bloodletting in Ukraine must come to an end. But getting there is hard, very hard. There is so little trust, and the Europeans, who want the conflict to continue, will do everything they can to prevent peace. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Karen Kwiatkowski, in Mount Jackson. She is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, having served at both NSA and the Office of Secretary of Defense. In Salt Lake City, we have David Pine. He is Deputy Director of National Operations for the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. And in Basel, we cross to Andrei Telyushenko. He is a former Ukrainian diplomat. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Karen, let me go to you first in Mount Jackson. So many things are happening. It's hard even for us that are newsy people to keep up with it. But I'd like to start with a very broad brush question to you. Over the particularly the last week or so, it seems to me that the post-World War II security and, importantly, cultural consensus in the West is falling apart. Is that a fair characterization?
It's either falling apart or the narrative about it is falling apart. One of the two things is happening. Reality is starting to emerge. It's undeniable. It's been undeniable for people that have been looking at this closely, but American politicians have not been. They've been playing a game for a long time, certainly under the past two administrations, really. So what Trump is trying to do, I think, is figure out what the truth is as a starting point.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, David, a lot of people were very, very critical of Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, when he came out and said the administration's approach, no NATO for Ukraine, no U.S. troops, Ukraine is going to have to accept territorial losses. And just as Karen just said, I mean, that these are facts. These are not creating political facts. These are hard realities. And he was criticized for it. But I think that's exactly the approach that has to be taken, because from that point, from starting from there, then you can deal with problems that both sides legitimately can raise. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, it's very refreshing to see top Trump administration officials talk in a realistic way. I mean, everyone knows that's going to be the end peace agreement. There's no peace possible unless a peace deal is minimally acceptable to the Russian Federation, and so I think the Trump administration is going about it in a good way. I don't think he gave up any leverage at all by making those statements, because Moscow, the Kremlin has made clear that there has to be an agreed upon peace framework that include some of their key elements of a peace deal in order for there to be a ceasefire. So I think Pete Hegseth's statements have moved us halfway there.
That's a good point. Andre, also, who gets a seat at the table here? As a former Ukrainian diplomat, I would posit the following. You obviously have the right to disagree with me, but Zelensky gave away Ukraine's sovereignty. So it with a country with no sovereignty, it doesn't have a seat at the table. That was a craven choice on the part of Zelensky and his clique around him, which of course he did. He followed orders from Washington and London and Brussels. So too bad you gave away your authority to be, and he's not even legitimately legally the president of Ukraine. So forfeiture, that's what did someone tell me recently? You play stupid games and you get stupid prizes. Go ahead, Andre.
I would agree on you on this. Unfortunately for my country, Zelensky and the former government in Ukraine under Poroshenko has let Ukraine totally down. It lost its total sovereignty after the coup in 2014, where I was in the government when we saw all of these manipulations by the United States Embassy, United States government, on telling Ukraine government what to do, who to appoint, who to fire, and who to hire, how to give them the money, and how to do the works in the government. Basically, we were a total unsovereign country. And today, Ukraine has lost it at the end of all what already has happened. With all the economic support from the West, Ukraine cannot sustain itself economically at this point. Zelensky not only is not a legitimate president. He is not able to speak for the country itself. The country is looking forward for change in Ukraine. Ukrainians, who even are prolonged with all this propaganda, do not want Zelensky there. So he does not represent the country. He cannot represent Ukraine on the peace talks. So what is the question is here? Who can represent Ukraine? Can the future elections make any change, because any of those who are going to be reelected, there's no opposition in Ukraine because it was destroyed by the West and kept quiet because they were supporting democracy in Ukraine. And so there's nobody to choose from. So what is the answer? Can Ukraine be represented properly here? Yes, it can. There's still a parliament, which is legitimate and can be part of the negotiations, but they can be only part after Russia and the United States agree upon a deal that will be represented not only to Ukraine, but to Europe itself, because Europe also lost its sovereignty in this situation, the former administration where basically gave away its all economic freedom to America.
Well, you know, again, seats at the table, Karen, the Europeans obviously are furious that they're not given a seat. But why should they be given a seat? They were entrusted with the Minsk process. They were failures. Not only were they failures, they lied. Okay, they lied to the public. They lied to the Russians. They lied, unfortunately, most of all, to the people of the Donbass. So they forfeited their seat at the table. And why in the world would Zelensky and the EU be given a seat? They don't want a peace. They want war. Why should they be able to sit at a peace conference? Go ahead,
yeah,
Karen.
Yeah, they should not be. They should not be. And I think, you know, the egregiousness of the admitted lies that Germany and others who were supposed to be the guarantors of the Minsk agreements, they publicly admitted some years later, after rumors were, people suspected this was the case, but they publicly embraced it as if it was a positive, as if lying and lying about your commitments to peace even years ago in 2014 was that was okay. That was okay. They were justified in doing that. So it is right for anyone who wants peace in Europe, and anyone who wants peace anywhere, to have nothing but contempt for most of the European leaders. They have not earned the right to sit at it. It's not only that they don't want it. They don't want peace. Clearly, they are dependent on this continued conflict. But they don't deserve a seat at the table, and they cannot be trusted. Those individuals and those who are supporting the ones who lied about their guarantor function and said, we just want to strengthen Ukraine for more war, anyone aligned with those people is automatically disqualified. And Zelensky chose very poorly with the friends that he would surround himself with.
Well, Dave, all the more so, David. I mean, we did have weeks after the conflict started in 2022, we had the Istanbul process. Again, Zelensky forfeited his country's fortunes, okay? Why would you trust someone like that to be around a negotiating table? I mean, he chose for himself and his clique around him and his Western friends. He chose badly for his own people. David.
You're absolutely right. Ukraine and the EU don't deserve a seat at the table because they've refused to sit at the table. Putin has been sitting alone at the table waiting for you know, the U.S. and Ukraine and I guess the EU to join him and end the conflict. And you know, NATO leaders, Biden and Ukraine have not allowed Russia to end the conflict with the negotiated peace agreement. You know, that's been 3 years. The Istanbul Agreement was, I think it would have been a victory for everyone. It would have been a win for Russia. It would have been a win for Ukraine. You know, Russia would have withdrawn from most of eight oblasts. Ukraine could have had 93% of its internationally recognized territory. Of course, Russia likely would have annexed the People's Republics and the Donetsk and Luhansk, but that would have been the end of it. Ukraine would have been neutral. It would have been at peace, and it would have been had true security, just as it had from 1991 to 2014, when it was a neutral buffer state between Russia and NATO. You know, buffer states protect both sides. Russia would be protected against NATO aggression. NATO would be protected against Russian aggression. And you know, Ukraine would not have lost 30% of its population as it has done today.
You know, Andre, The one group of people that are missing in this equation are the Ukrainian people. We do know that for well over a year now, well over a year now, public opinion polls in Ukraine, and I'm sure it's not the freest environment to do public opinion polls, but a majority of people want a settlement, okay? Again, a man that is no longer legally the president of your country is making decisions, and that's even against the will of his own people.
Yeah, of course. Here, the Ukrainians are not being heard at all because the West has been basically closing down Ukraine and closing down anything on the Ukraine so-called democracy because the borders are closed. The people who fled the country, paid bribes to the country, and the people who left are in Ukraine, cannot leave because they don't have the money or afraid to leave the country because the border is closed, they're going to get shot. And today, nobody's hearing them. Nobody's hearing the people who are abroad, Ukrainians, who are in Europe, who are in Russia. There's millions of Ukrainians in Russia who are not being heard of. And Ukrainians in Ukraine are being basically put to the ground, and nobody's talking about them. I just spoke to a couple of journalists last week from Wall Street Journal, and they're like, oh, we hate Tucker Carlson because he went to Russia and showed what the situation in Russia is and talking about peace with the Russian Federation. But at the same time, I said, why aren't you talking about the real situation? Tucker Carlson talking about the real situation in Russia and talking to Putin. Why aren't you talking to Ukrainians? Why you're not talking and showing the real situation, how Ukrainians are being thrown as dogs to the front lines and are not being even questioned? What do they want? The real peace in Ukraine, they want real peace. They don't care who they're going to be controlled by, the Russia. And if it's going to be Russia, let it be Russia. That's what people are saying. We just want peace and get our lives back, and we just want our country to be developing back again. That's what they want. But the West says, no, they're closing their eyes on this. They don't want to even talk about it because they are afraid of the truth, because if the truth comes out, the whole Western so-called deep globalist movement is going to fall apart.
I'm really glad you brought it up. I mean, well over a million, I think it's 1.3 million Ukrainians came to Russia after the SMO started, okay? I've never heard that in history where the so-called aggressor accepts people fleeing that are apparently fleeing to the people that are oppressing them. That is never mentioned in Western media, and I'm really glad that you brought it up. All right, folks, I'm going to jump in here, and we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Karen. I think we've kind of laid out the groundwork here about how to move forward. But as I said in my introduction, this is going to be very, very hard because to this, even with all the expressions of goodwill and wanting to get this done, finally, I have to take a step back and look at our terms and conditions of engagement here. You still hear among people that want this conflict to end, they keep using the word ceasefire. That's not what the Russians want, okay? Trump wants an end to the conflict. Well, I want the end of the conflict, but for the conflict to end, the security issues that Russia has have to be addressed. It's just not going to be a ceasefire. It's not going to be November 11th, 1918, okay? If it were that case, then it would be easy, but Russia is not going to accept that. It's not going to accept a ceasefire. Karen.
Yeah, no, that is true. And I think a lot of what's going on now with the long meetings and even the hectic schedule is, I think the Trump administration we can accept that they have been very ill-informed about the situation in Ukraine. He knows, I think the Trump people understand Europe a little bit better, which is why Vance was so humiliating towards them when his meeting recently. But the Trump people, they don't understand the bottom line situation. They don't have a clear sense, I don't believe yet, of the cards that Russia holds militarily on the battlefield in terms of the economy, in terms of their messaging, which is Russia's messaging has been so remarkably consistent from day one on this whole thing. But Americans, and certainly Trump, wasn't paying much attention to that. So his people, Witzkoff, is not an expert on Ukraine. He's a deal maker, a real estate guy. So they are trying, I believe, to understand the ground rules. And certainly, Trump's all about momentum.
Yep.
But I think they're learning. They're taking the time to learn and listen. And also, Trump has other priorities beyond Ukraine. He sees Ukraine as a problem. Russia, he wants to be friends with. Europe, he wants to continue to humiliate and exploit, unfortunately, which is, I'm not a fan of NATO, so I don't mind that. But for Europeans, this is a bad time for them. And that's a totally different issue than killing Ukrainians, which is something our U.S. Congress has been doing enthusiastically.
Well, I wish I could share your sentiment when it comes to Europe. The Europeans are getting what they deserve, okay? They need a massive wake-up call, all right? And I'm not a fan of NATO. Anyone that watches this program knows that. But I have to say, Karen, that I gleefully watch the Europeans destroy NATO, not Trump. It's the Europeans that are doing it. Okay, you know, when your adversaries are in a circular firing squad, don't get in the way. Okay, but that'll be another topic for another program. David, do you worry that we may have our expectations may be too high?
A little bit. Yeah, I think there's a chance that you know, the neocons in the Trump administration might overestimate Ukraine's position or the U.S. position. As Karen mentioned, you know, Russia has been winning this war comprehensively. They've inflicted probably 1.1 million Ukrainian military casualties at the cost of maybe 250,000 Russians, of which only 100,000 have been killed. So, you know, Russia has an extreme advantage, 5-to-1 numerical advantage on most areas of the Eastern Front. And, you know, it's important that, you know, I think the biggest area of dispute in any final peace agreement is going to be demilitarization of the Ukrainian military. You know, Kellogg's statements were just outrageous. You know, we're going to build up the Ukrainian military and modernize it after the war. After a peace deal, and that's completely unacceptable to Russia. You know, it has to be 100,000 Ukrainian troop limit, just as was in the Istanbul Agreement on the Russian side. Maybe we can increase the size of the border guard forces that would be non-military in peacetime conditions, and we have to see the demilitarization of the four oblasts. You know, I think maybe that's one area that I hope that Russia can concede to make peace along the line of control. I think Trump does understand Russia. He does have strategic empathy for Russia. He's made clear statements that you know, the U.S. would never accept you know, an enemy country along our borders. So I'm incredibly hopeful of what I see. I think overall the Trump administration is doing an excellent job. And if that causes fissures with our client states in NATO, I'm fine with that.
Well, you know, Andre, again, you know, so much is being talked about Ukraine, but what do Ukrainians think? Can Ukraine, I mean, it looks like that, you know, at least the current leadership or people in power in Ukraine, they want to move towards European Union membership. That's up to the Ukrainian people. But I mean, after all this has happened, do you think Ukraine can trust Europe?
I don't think Ukraine cannot trust anybody right now at all in this situation. Ukraine saw what Europe is already. After 2014, the promises of the so-called free world European Union and trips to Vienna and having coffee in Vienna by Poroshenko are now in a bloodshed. And Ukrainians understand that they need to be where they are and be left alone. And this is what the Trump administration needs to understand and the Western world. Ukraine has to be left alone. If Trump really wants peace, he needs to start acting on it and start getting all the U.S. intel groups out of Ukraine. There's more than 16 of them in Ukraine who were preparing Ukrainians for war, were preparing the Ukrainian military for war and the so-called Azov and Nazi battalion groups for war with Russia, and they were assisting them today. So they have to do that. They have to leave Ukraine at all. Let's leave Ukraine sovereign, have the diplomatic corps stay in Ukraine, keep it official, and leave Ukraine alone where it could handle its situation with Russia after the peace deal is going to be made between the United States and Russia, because the war was started by the West, by letting Ukraine into this war. So Europe is a future for Ukraine, I think, is not an option. Ukraine.
But I think Ukraine may have a future if USAID would get out of Ukraine and stop meddling. I mean, you know, you turn on BBC and Al Jazeera, and they have this, you know, human rights lawyer, okay, that speaks pretty good English. She's blonde. She's pretty. She's on the payroll of USAID. You're not getting the opinion from Ukrainians. You're getting it from the foreign policy blob in the West that actually is against the Trump administration as we speak, okay? That's part of the root problem for Ukraine, is that we get a very distorted picture of what people think. And needless to say, the junk that you can see on Telegram. Karen, we were talking before the program started. 4.5 hours, that was the length of the first meeting in Riyadh. And I'm pretty much betting, and you agreed with me, and I'd like to explain to our viewers, that a good part of that conversation, if not all of it actually, was about U.S.-Russia relations. Why were you agreeing with me? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, we've had this incredible, unbelievable gap in our U.S.-Russia relations with Biden. And of course, Biden was not a competent leader of our country in terms of speaking to his fellow leaders. We know that. But there was also a very aggressive anti-Russian view throughout the Biden government, throughout the Democratic Party, and unfortunately, throughout the Republican Party. So you had bipartisan anti-Russianism, Russophobia, institutionalized for really over 4 years. So Trump was personally affected by this, his first impeachment related to that. And Zelensky's people and Zelensky's government, this is why Zelensky should be very nervous. You know, Trump has some good features, but he also is someone who holds a grudge. He remembers people who have betrayed him. This loyalty idea is very important to him. And it's part of his success. And he does not trust Zelensky at all. So on a personal level. So this is, all of this has to be fixed. But yes, the Russia thing is most important. Also, Trump understands, with his Greenland gambit, you know, he understands raw materials, he understands strategic location. He does this maybe from a real estate perspective, maybe as an American imperialist, if you want to call it that. But he understands that. And so Russia counts. You talk to Russia. You negotiate with Russia. Make sure there's an understanding with Russia. Ukraine, unfortunately, for Trump, for personal reasons and political reasons and historical reasons, does not count for him. So these early talks are definitely about the bilateral relationship, which is good, because we have to do that before we can find out what the Ukrainian people deserve, which is peace.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. And it's a neutral peace. It is a peace that doesn't threaten anyone, a peace that is profitable. You know, in fact, you know, we know peace is profitable. It really is. Yeah. War, we talk about how much money you can make. Only a few people make money from war. Peace, everyone becomes wealthy in a peaceful environment.
And Karen, after all of the bloodshed and all of the violence, there is no hatred of Ukrainians in Russia. Russians don't hate Ukrainians, okay? USAID helped Ukrainians spread Russophobia around the world. But after everything that's been, the losses on both sides, there's still not animosity towards Ukraine and Ukrainian people. Against people like Zelensky, well, obviously that's different. David, you know, one of the things, going back to 2014, the origins of this conflict, everybody, not 2022, 2014, you know, Russia and the United States don't necessarily have to be friends, but they should not be enemies. I think that's more true now than ever before. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. That's the greatness of President Trump, is in a single day, he essentially transformed Russia from an adversary to a rival and a competitor, great power competitor versus an enemy. And that's something we didn't see in the Biden administration. And the whole key to U.S. security is to neutralize the Sino-Russian alliance. And the way you do that is to have friendly relations with both Moscow and Beijing, and to increase investments and ties with Russia, with India, to end this talk about a new security architecture in Europe that includes Russia with indivisible security. that benefits all, provides security to all. This is something that Russia's been advocating since the days of the Soviet Union in 1989.
Well, historically, Yalta is a betrayal. I'll take Yalta 2.0 in a New York minute if it brings peace, all right? That's all the time we have. Fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Basel, Mount Jackson, and in Salt Lake City. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.